Good morning, and it's good to be with you. And I'm so delighted to be part of this series that you're doing on Nehemiah, because it's such a good story. I'm sorry that I haven't got Nehemiah 8, because I think it's one of my favourite chapters, but we've got Nehemiah 2 today. And it is a good story. Don't get distracted by all the strange names and the complicated politics, things that you can't get your head round. If you like, play it like a film in your head. Try and picture what's going on. I'm sure Kate has already set the scene for you, but we'll just recap it quickly because you may not have been here or you may have forgotten. Israel, the people of God, almost the whole nation, have been captured, they've been overrun, they've been uprooted, taken away to Babylon, what was Persia, and is now Iraq. And their beloved country has been devastated. Jerusalem's in ruins, the temple's been destroyed, and as it says right at the beginning of the book, they're in great trouble and disgrace. So there they are, most of them in Babylon, living in exile. And they were there a long time, and it wasn't all that bad. Nehemiah, who's the focus of our story, had a good job. He worked at the court. He was the king's wine steward. He was doing very nicely. And yet when he hears news of what has happened back home in Jerusalem, he's completely overcome. And he spends some time just praying and fasting and mourning for what has happened to his beloved country. And then, of course, he has to wait for the right moment to do something about it. You didn't just charge into the king and say, hey, I think I'm going to take a few weeks off. I want to go back home. And he waited 3 months until eventually he approaches the king with fear and trembling. And then he says something wonderful. The gracious hand of God was upon me. And the king not only gives him permission to go back to Jerusalem, he provides him with materials to start rebuilding, a letter of safe passage to the governor, and an armed guard to see him through the journey. And we pick up the story today when he's arrived. The story doesn't tell us that it probably took getting on for 3 months to get there. You know, you didn't just jump on the bus or the train or your car or even fly. It was a tough journey. And I don't know whether you noticed, but it says he arrived and he stayed there 3 days. He didn't do anything for 3 days. Not because he was jet-lagged, but probably recovering from that journey and preparing himself for what he'd come to do. He needed to be at his best. And just think about what he found. He must have been devastated to see this great city. The walls of the city had gone, the gates had been destroyed, and the few people who were left there, they were exposed, they were unprotected. And it doesn't take much imagination to think what the atmosphere, the mood of the place must have been like. There would be fear, there would be despair. I imagine they were pretty depressed and pretty hopeless. And here's Nehemiah. He's left a good job, relative comfort and security, gone on this long, difficult journey because of what God had put in his heart. This is one of the things I love about this, because it's so unlike so many Old Testament stories. We only have the record of Nehemiah's prayers, and they're wonderful prayers. But he doesn't tell us anything about what God said or what God did. He doesn't hear a voice. He doesn't see a vision. There's no guiding angel. Just this burning in his heart that this is what God is telling him to do. And praise the Lord that we've got this story, because it's so much closer to our experience, isn't it? There are very, very few of us who actually hear a voice when God speaks to us. and still less who see visions or meet angels. And when we have this thing in our hearts, this burning that God's saying something to us, it raises the question, well, how do we know that it's God? How do you know it isn't just some bad idea that's suddenly come into your head? You know, how do you know that something is of God? Let me use a personal illustration. Some of you may know that I used to be the minister of the Baptist Church on Mill Road in Cambridge. And many years ago now, we had an open day. We'd done a lot of work in the church itself, in the worship area. We'd put in new heating, a new PA system, and repainted it. But especially, we'd put in new windows. And if you've been down Mill Road, you'll see that there's a lovely stained glass window. And so we had an open day to invite everybody in the area, as well as our own congregation and friends, to come and see what we'd done and just celebrate and have a good day together. And it was a great day and it went really well. And after it was over and almost everybody had gone and we were just sort of clearing up the debris, one of the deacons and I were clearing up the barbecue and we're reflecting, as one does, on how the day had gone and how pleased we were with what the work that had been done in the church. But of course, most of the open day had been in the old buildings at the back. And so we were looking at them and thinking, what do we do with this lot? The church had been wrestling and exploring and debating for years, long before I went, about what they were going to do with these old buildings and had got absolutely nowhere. And Andrew and I were standing there saying, well, what are we going to do with them? Because they were really past their sell-by date. And to this day, I don't think either of us can remember who said it first or whether we said it together, but we just suddenly looked at each other and said, let's pull the lot down. No voices, no flashing lights, no visions. But it was one of those moments when you know this is of God. And we never doubted from then on that this was the right thing to do. And it was a huge, scary project, far bigger and more frightening than we realised when we said, oh, let's pull it down. And it wasn't without its difficulties and its opposition. But the lovely thing was that God opened up the way in ways that left us breathless and amazed. His gracious hand was upon us. And I've always thought that it's a good test when something comes into your heart to ask, firstly, does it stay? Does it persist? What a wonderful lady who did a great project in Cambridge many years ago called, is there that persistent whisper? Or does that idea just sort of fritter away and you think, oh, well, never mind. Does it persist? And then do subsequent events confirm it? Is God's hand on it and in it? Nehemiah has this call from God. It's burning in his heart and it won't go away. So now he's got to get real. He's got to get practical. He's got to do something about it. And he's got to find out what it is that this call means. What he's really got to do. What is God calling him to do? Because until he knows what God's calling him to do, he can't really inspire others. You know, he hasn't ridden into town in a one-man crusade like John Wayne, brandishing his gun and saying, I've come to sort you out. He hasn't even come, you know, with a pickaxe at a spirit level and said, you know, I'm going to come and rebuild Jerusalem. This is a together project. He's got to do this with the people. And if you notice, as you go through the story, everything he says is, we're in trouble. Let us rebuild. But first, he needs to know what it is they're facing. And so he goes out at night because he doesn't want anybody to look and say, what's he up to? Why is he here? So he goes out with just a few trusted friends in the middle of the night to see what the problem is, to make a thorough assessment. And that's a pretty hazardous business, just trying to do it in the dark. No street lights, no nothing. And in fact, he tells us that it's so difficult that in places his poor old donkey couldn't even get through the rubble and the mess. But now he knows what they're facing. And it's time to start doing something. And he gets the people together. This is the situation. They know what he says, you see what a mess we're in. Let's do something about it. And yes, that's pretty obvious. They know what mess they're in. They probably know it needs putting right. But the important thing is, why? There must have been people who said, well, it's been like this for a long time now, so why bother? And it's very easy to get used to things as they are, even if they're not very good. When we first moved into our present house, there was some paper hanging off the bathroom ceiling, and it stayed like that for years. We just sort of got used to it. It wasn't until we had somebody coming to stay, and I thought, oh, it's time we stuck that paper back or did something about it. They'd got used to living in this mess. And it would be very easy for people to say, well, we're managing okay. And anyway, it's too big, it's too difficult, it's just too much. We can't do it. But Nehemiah faces them with the real issue. Jerusalem and the temple were not just the capital, not just the heart of the nation. This was where they focused their relationship with God. This represented God with them. It was the focal point of where they worshipped. Their understanding, their sense that God was with them, where they met with God. And the fact that it had been destroyed and desecrated, for a start, spoke to them that they had sinned, they disobeyed. God had turned from them. But it also was seen by all the nations round them who worshipped other gods, that their God, this God of Israel, had been defeated and had abandoned them. They, as Nehemiah's brother said when he first took Nehemiah that message in the first chapter, they were in great trouble and disgrace. And Nehemiah's great concern is that God is being the subject of scorn and abuse by their neighbours. This situation wasn't giving God the glory. It wasn't proclaiming the kingdom. And the people themselves had lost that sense and assurance of God with them. They were adrift. And this would really come home when you get as far as chapter 8. They realised just how far out of line with God they are. And sometimes this can be the situation in our churches, in our church life. We may not be ravaged by marauding armies, but nonetheless, we can lose our way simply by getting used to the status quo. Well, we've always done it like this and we're getting on all right and it's very comfortable. And yet we can just be going through the motions and neither bringing glory to God or working for the kingdom. I don't know if that's true here, but I've certainly seen that situation in other churches. Things have just gone on because they've always gone on. And it almost needs a Nehemiah to come in and say, look, this is perhaps not trouble and disgrace, but it's something that needs rebuilding, starting again. And that's demanding. And it's challenging, whatever it may be. It asks for a humility to recognise and admit that something needs doing. And to admit that actually I haven't done anything about it before. It asks for courage. So it always takes courage to change. You never know what change is going to demand, what sort of commitment it's going to need. And it asks for sacrifice, time and energy. Sometimes it means giving up one's comfort zone. Moving into the unknown can always be a bit frightening and threatening. And often it's a sacrifice of one's material resources as well. Nehemiah was able to make that call and inspire the people. Yes, because he totally identified with them. We've sinned, we've acted wickedly, we've not obeyed God. I'm part of this, he's saying. We're in trouble and disgrace. And yes, he was prepared to get alongside them and roll his sleeves up and get his hands dirty, work hard, even put his life at risk. But the main reason was because he'd already seen God at work. He told the people how God's gracious hand had been on him. And what the king had said. And that was a miracle in itself. He could have been thrown in the dungeon or worse simply for looking miserable in the presence of the king when he took his wine in. Let alone for saying he wanted leave of absence. But he saw God's hand in this and it confirmed that burning in his heart. And he says to the people, this is of God. And all the people replied, let's do it.